Thank you for inviting me. It's very good of you. I do appreciate the opportunity of coming here. It's like coming home. I seem to know you so well. One of the other things I love is that you're all so young, which is so nice. Where we go, we're one of the youngest, so that's it's a real pleasure to come where there are young people who are prepared to join together and to praise and worship God together. So it's a delight. It is said by one of the commentators that it was on the Mount of Sinai that the children of Israel were forged into a nation. I think that's rather nice. It wasn't an easy journey, was it? We'll read just the first few verses of chapter 20, which contains the Ten Commandments. And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or it is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. I'll stop there because you're going to go through the other commandments as we go on, and I'm sure you'll read them over the coming days. There's one passage in the... Well, how do you choose a favourite passage? My favourite passage today, well, yeah, I think it probably will be the same, but I have so many that speak to me so often. But one of the ones that I have that I come back to regularly in the Old Testament is Exodus 34, a little bit further on in the story. And particularly verses 5 to 8. God had met with Moses again on the mountain, and Moses was overwhelmed, and he said, this is when he went back to get the commandments again, because if you know the story, he'd broken them in anger. And Moses had said, I want to see you, God. I want to see you face to face. I want to see you, Lord. And he said in from verse 5, the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. And Moses quickly bowed his head toward the earth and worshipped. That's it, isn't it? Moses bowed his head quickly before the earth, toward the earth, and worshipped. The verses that we've got give us an introduction, a preamble, and a historical background to the Decalogue, to the Ten Commandments that we've looked at. The Israelites were commanded to obey God on the double basis of who he is and what he had done for them. We will look at the history of it and just have a quick brief review of the early chapters of Exodus. Because every time God comes and says, I'm to be your God, the children of Israel say, wow, why not? Look at what God has done. Look at what God has done. Most scholars have divided the Ten Commandments into two groups, but in different ways. The older Jewish method, which is called the Philonic, after a guy called Philo, nothing to do with pastry, obviously, was to divide them in two groups of five commandments each. And the Jews believed that that's how they were put on the tablets of stone, as we've seen there. There's a newer Christian interpretation, which is called the Augustinian, after Augustine, the church father. He divided them into the first three and the last seven. The basis for this division is the subject matter of these various commandments. The first three commandments deal with man's relationship with God, and the last seven with his relationship with other people, or the relationships with other people. Man's relationship with other people. So the first three are how we have our relationship with God. The seven is how we deal with each other in our everyday lives. And really this is summed up, isn't it, by Jesus in Matthew 22, when he was challenged about the commandments. And Jesus said this in verses 36 to 40 of Matthew 22. Jesus said to him, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. The second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets depend on these two commandments." So the commandments of the first three are so important, because until we get our relationship with God right, ourselves, we cannot be expected to get our relationship with each other correct. How can we be expected to deal with each other if we have not got our relationship with God right? Some scholars think that each tablet contained all 10 commandments, in keeping with the ancient Near East custom of making duplicates of covenant documents. So they would have the 10 commandments on each tablet. It doesn't really matter, does it? The Lutheran and Roman Catholic churches follow the Augustinian method, and they divide verses 2 to 6 to be the first commandment, and then they divide the verse 17 on covetousness into two, making the 10. But we follow the Judaistic pattern, making verse 2 the first commandment and verses 3 to 6 the second. I don't think it really matters, but well, we could go into that, couldn't we? But basically this is a call to monotheism, one God. Monotheism, faithfulness to the Lord. Israel was to have no other God before Yahweh. He had revealed himself to them, and he was not just to be the first among several gods, that's called henotheism, but to be the only one, monotheism. And it's throughout the New Testament, in Corinthians, in Timothy, in Acts, in James and John, they all talk about one God. And if you remember your history, the early church suffered persecution over this basic principle. In the Roman Empire, they were very adept at absorbing the religions and the gods of all the peoples they conquered. The Romans would allow you to continue worship your specific deities. They probably even adopted Druidism into their pantheon of gods when they came to England. It was fine. That was okay. You could worship whichever god you wanted, providing you acknowledged that the Roman God, and this from Augustus onwards was Caesar himself, that he was the supreme God. I keep saying until people get really tired of it, but when the Apostle Paul said Jesus is Lord, he was speaking treasonously. He was speaking against the state, which said that Caesar was Lord. And it was so dangerous. He could have been, well, he was in the end, wasn't he, arrested and executed, we're told. Yahweh had opened himself to a special relationship with Israel. But that relationship could only develop if Israel committed themselves to Yahweh alone. I mean, he says, doesn't he, "I'm a jealous God." He said, "You can't have me and somebody else. It's me or nothing. You know, we have to have this relationship together." But Yahweh did more than just say, "I want you to be mine." He demonstrated his power in such amazing ways. He had delivered them. He had guided them. And then he'd come to them. And the next step, if there was a next step, was that they had to belong to him. They had to willingly commit themselves to him. If they were to remain in his presence, in other words, if they were going to follow him and be his people, there could be no room for any other gods. None at all. And I think we have to say, don't we, that if this is true of the children of Israel all these centuries ago, the millennia ago, whenever they were
wandering the earth and wandering the desert. If that's true of them, then it has to be true to us, and the same principle must apply to us as 21st century Christians. There can be only one God in our lives. There is no room for any other. I think I'd like to go and have a little bit of context to understand the background, where all this comes from. I'm sure you've been through that. You've been going through Exodus, yes? I'm going to repeat it all for you. But it might be interesting because your understanding and my understanding and the way I look at things might be slightly different. I promise you they are, because I've got a weird sense of humour. I've also got a weird sense of what's right and wrong. Anyway, that doesn't matter. We go back to Genesis chapter 12. God calls Abraham as he was called. He calls him from paganism to be the father of God's chosen people. Why did he choose Abraham? We're not told, other than it was God's sovereign choice. Of all the people that were around, God chose Abraham. He looked at this man and he chose him to be the father of his people. Genesis 14 tells us later on that there was a man of the time, a king called Melchizedek, who was king of Salem and a priest of God Most High, El Elyon. So he was a worshipper of God. So God had his faithful people in the world already. Abraham was a pagan. God had his people, but he didn't choose Melchizedek or anybody from Salem. He chose Abraham. And he was the one with whom God had a covenant agreement, and he would develop a covenant relationship. It was God's sovereign choice. And the remainder and chapters of Genesis tell us of the ups and downs of family life. Abraham and his desire for a son. He grew from being one man with a wife who was desperate for children, who got to the point where, humanly speaking, biologically speaking, it was impossible. And so he agreed that his wife should his wife agreed that he should have a child with one of her serving maids. And then God gave him his son, Isaac. And you know perhaps the story of all that. And then the family developed, didn't it, until there were 12 sons and their families. And a famine comes on the land. They have to take a refuge in Egypt. But it's dreadful. But God had already sent one of the sons ahead, Joseph. And Joseph and his family become supreme. And they stay in Egypt as a refuge. And they are settled. But it doesn't last long. Exodus, the book of Exodus, tells us that a new power, and they think it was a conqueror, came to Egypt and took over Egypt. They conquered Egypt, and they knew nothing of Joseph and what he had done for the Egyptians. All they saw was a threat, a huge threat, from a very large non-indigenous people living right next door to them and presenting a huge threat to the security of this Egyptian state. If an enemy comes along, we've got these thousands of people who could side with them and take over. And so they decided that they would have to do something about it, and so they enslaved them. They turned them into slaves. It's interesting that in all the time this is going on, God is with them. God has never left them. They prospered. They grew in numbers. You read the story. The indications in the text suggest that they were very fertile as a people group. And they had many children. Now, this is quite radical, because in those days when infant mortality and the death of the mother in childbirth was very, very common, it's nothing less than a miracle. The children of Israel grew dramatically. And the Egyptians were even more worried, so they had to become even harsher in their slavery methods. And slavery just didn't seem to do it. The more they persecuted the people, the harsher they were in their slavery, the more the people seemed to thrive, and the more babies were born. And so they tried genocide. They decided they would kill off all the boy babies. I mean, this was, again, was very subtle, because if you kill off all the boys, the girls that are left behind will presumably want a husband. Who have they got to the choice? It's going to have to be an Egyptian. And so the children of Israel would gradually, over a few generations, just be wiped out and would be non-existent. There wouldn't be any Jews anymore. They would just be Egyptians if all the boys gone. But then when we come to chapter 2 of Exodus, the story takes on a personal note. We're introduced to a man, the man that God chose to be the leader of his people. You must know the story of Moses and the bulrushes, how he was put into the basket and floated on the river when he was a few weeks old, because I don't know what babies were like, I suppose they were like, they would cry, maybe the rocking of the water would soothe him. And the revelation that God has with his people that we're looking at in the Ten Commandments is linked inextricably with Moses. You can't have the Ten Commandments without Moses. Moses and the Ten Commandments go together. And this boy, this baby is born. He's not the youngest, he's not the oldest in the family, he's not the youngest. We're not told much other than the fact that he had an older sister, and we know he had a younger brother. But he couldn't be kept safe. His mother did not throw him in the river as she was supposed to. She put him in the waterproof basket and left him in the reeds, hoping that no one would hear him. But somebody did hear him. That was Pharaoh's daughter, and she adopted him. And she then had, of course, had him cared for by his own mother. Again, all this is in the provision of God. And Acts 7, we have to go into Acts, that tells us that when Moses was 40 years old, although raised in an Egyptian household, he identified with his own people. We're not told how or why. So many fascinating things that aren't there. We're not told how Moses knew he was not Egyptian. Maybe there were physical characteristics that identified him as an Israelite rather than as an Egyptian. But he identifies with his own people, and again, this is a story of he sees someone being abused, a Hebrew being abused, and he steps in and he kills the man who kills the Egyptian. And then he has to run for his life. He runs for his life. He runs into the land of the Midians. He runs to a Midianite family. He marries one of the daughters and has a family of his own. It's all there. It's a fascinating story. I'm not sure. I think if you look at the stories of it, Moses probably stayed in Midian for about 40 years. He was 40 years old, and he stayed there for about 40 years. He became a shepherd. He became a shepherd and stayed there 40 years. The only reason we say that, we're not told that, but it says when Moses had been in the wilderness for 40 years with the children of Israel, he died 120. So we can work it back and think that he was probably about 80 when he came back. Again, this is quite remarkable for the time. We saw in chapter 2 that Moses tried to intervene with the relationship with the Hebrew people as slaves, with the Egyptian power, and he failed. He may have killed one man who was abusing one of his fellow people, but he hadn't led them out of slavery, he hadn't led them to freedom, he'd done nothing. All he'd had to do was himself run away and hide, which he did for 40 years. But the reason for the failure was that he was acting alone, and this was not God's time. And then, thinking about this, looking through this passage, I'm drawn to the parallels that we have in our own Christian life, in our own walk and discipleship. How many times have we tried to do our own thing? We were talking about it earlier, about 5-year plans, 3-year plans even, or even plans for our church, for our fellowship. We should constantly, shouldn't we, be looking to Jesus and the Spirit for their clear direction in our life, individually, and as a fellowship. You know, I think we were saying again, we sort of, what's the principle? Is it Paul says, to know Christ and to make him known. That's to be the plan for our fellowship, doesn't it? We want others to come to know Christ, but we need to know him better so we can tell more of him. So I don't agree with five-year plans, you've probably gathered. But we can't use that as a reason for inaction. We can't just say, oh, well, we'll just wait for God. We have to be seen to be doing things, but we have to be doing things that the Bible tells us we need to do. So Moses, there he is, a shepherd in Midian for perhaps 40 years. But I mean, there again, what a training ground. He wandered around the deserts, around the wildernesses of Midian. David was a shepherd as well, wasn't he? David was a shepherd, and he became the greatest king Israel has, and he had his training ground as a shepherd. So Moses is there, presumably settled into a very happy family life. He has a wife, he has children, he's got a family around him. But God hasn't finished with Moses. God's time is now right for the release of the children of Israel from their slavery. I think it's quite fascinating. We're told so little about Moses. I don't know. Who's seen the film The Ten Commandments? A very old film now. Anybody seen the film The Ten? Very, very old film. Shows how Moses was brought up as a prince. He probably was. But what else has happened? We don't know. He was raised, presumably, to worship the gods of Egypt. We're not told. Did he know anything of the history of his own people? We're not told. He'd obviously known his mother when he was younger, because she'd been basically his wet nurse for a few years, perhaps, and maybe she'd told him as an infant something of his history of his own people. We're not told. Was Moses' intervention between the Egyptian slave master and the Hebrew slave simply because Moses didn't like injustice? But whatever had gone on in Moses' life, God now calls Moses to one of what must be the most amazing jobs, the most amazing call that a man has ever had from God. You think about it. Moses is sent back from his comfortable life as a shepherd, from his family life, to lead this vast nation of, some people suggest, maybe even 1 million people. The estimates of how many there were coming out of Egypt vary, but it could be up to 1 million people. He was going to lead them away from a very, very powerful nation, Egypt. It had a huge army. Not to mention the slave masters who would have been in control of all the people. And he was going to lead them where? To a land that God was going to show them, where they would no longer be slaves, but they're going to be free. They won't only just be free from slavery, but they're going to be free to worship the God of their fathers, Yahweh, the great I Am, the God who revealed himself to Abraham all those years ago, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Exodus goes on to tell us all the excuses Moses made and the confrontations he then had with Pharaoh, who was very reluctant to lose his workforce. In days when there was no mechanization, the only thing you had was manpower, physical manpower. And if you look at some of the obelisks that were made in the Stone Age, just thousands and thousands of hours of somebody rubbing a piece of stone on another stone with sand to grind away very, very slowly. It took thousands and thousands of man hours. And of course, with slaves, you had it. But Pharaoh didn't want to lose his workforce. God had armed Moses with some amazing powers. And he used them, first of all, to demonstrate to his own people. He had to convince his own people. Somebody turned up, you know, out of the blue and said, I've come to lead you to freedom. They need convincing. And first of all, Moses had to convince the children of Israel. And then he had to convince the Egyptians. But he said, you know, I am come in the name of the great I Am. I've come in the name of Yahweh, the God of your fathers. And initially, again, if you read the story, his interventions don't work well, and he makes things worse, seemingly, and the children of Israel turn on him because Pharaoh said, oh, you can go, and you've got to make bricks, but I'm not going to give you the straw. You've got to get your own straw. And so things get worse rather than get better. And so the children of Israel turn on Moses, and Moses sort of turns to God and says, what have you done? You've made it worse. You've not made it better. But then we get the wonderful passage, don't we, the 10 plagues. And you need to read it through again and to look at it and to see how Moses and Pharaoh battle. But it's not between Moses and Pharaoh, is it? It's between God and the gods of Egypt. It's interesting, isn't it, that Pharaoh kept agreeing when there was a plague came along. The first one, when the Nile was turned to blood, oh, yes, goodness me, get rid of it, yeah, you can have whatever you want, go. So the blood goes, the river flows again, and Moses says, I'm not changing my mind, you can't go. And this kept going on, and the Bible calls it hardening of the heart. And in Exodus 8, in some of the verses there, it says that Pharaoh hardens his heart. And this goes on. But eventually, in the verses, and there's a number, read again, read them through, that it's not Pharaoh who hardens his heart, but God hardens Pharaoh's heart. Now, I find it quite a difficult concept to understand, but it's almost as if God is serving notice on us, that God, who is so tolerant and so forgiving, has his limits. He gets to the point, he says, enough's enough. Now, I know grace is abundant, but it's an interesting concept to look at. But God says, just, okay, that's what you want, that's what you can have. And so God hardens Pharaoh's heart, and it goes all the way through. The 9 plagues that attack the very basis of religious life in Egypt. God is destroying the Egyptian gods. The Nile was a god. The Nile provided the inundation, the flooding every year that flooded out over the lands and deposited the silt and everything else that made the Nile delta so prosperous, so fertile, which was the basis of their wealth. The Nile was considered a god. And the first plague showed the power of God. It turned it from a beautiful river into a stinking morass of rotting blood. We can't imagine it, can we? And so God goes all the way through, and he systematically destroys all the gods of Egypt until finally he comes one when the angel of death and the darkness, of course, is Ra that he was attacking, the sun god. But this carries on until the final battle when the angel of death comes along and claims the lives of all the firstborn in the land. Unless, of course, they were under protection of the blood. And finally, Pharaoh lets them go, lets the children of Israel go, and they leave, not empty-handed, but they're leaving, taking with them such plunder that it almost seems to be recompense for all the years of slavery. The Egyptians themselves were so pleased to see them go that they were handing over everything they had, all the gold and treasure and the clothes and everything else, wagon loads of it. Just go, get out of it, we don't want you here anymore. And after the dramatic events of God's deliverance of the Red Sea, when God again showed his great power over nature and destroyed the Egyptian army, God leads them to this holy mount, to Sinai, in the Sinai desert there. And in a most dramatic way, he comes and finally meets his own people face to face. What does it say? I am the Lord, I am your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt, from the house of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. And the people might say, well, why would we? Why would we? We've seen your power now over these last, I don't know how many it was, months or years. We've seen your power. Why would we want to have a God other than you? And so after a time of preparation, Moses went up to Mount Sinai, and there he met with God. Verses 5 to 6 in Exodus 19 sets out God's basis for the covenant relationship he will have with his people. He says, I will be your God if you will be my people. You will obey me, you will be my people. You will do what I say, you will follow me. exclusively. And the Ten Commandments, as we heard earlier, are the basis of the relationship between God and his people. It's a covenant. It's a relationship. It's the way things are going to work. The children of Israel in their time in Egypt would have been surrounded by the Egyptian gods day after day. It's thought that there were conservatively at least 2,000 Egyptian deities in Egypt that covered every aspect of their lives. That's why the plagues were designed for. The frogs, there was a frog-headed god. Every time of god you can imagine the Egyptians has. They'd got everything covered. They didn't want to leave anybody out, just in case. Every part of life was covered by a different god. What Yahweh is saying, what the great I Am is telling his people very, very clearly in these words, is that you don't have to have a god to cover every eventuality. You need to have a god who is everywhere. I'm not limited, he says, by time and space. He says, I am everywhere. There is no limit to who I am and what I can do. I am. Present continuous, not I do not have a past, I don't have a future, but I am now. I am. I exist in this minute, in this second. I am Yahweh, your God, who brought you out of Egypt from the non-status of slaves. You had nothing. You owned nothing. You had no opportunities. You had no future except to be worked to death, basically. But if we're going to have a covenant relationship, you're to have no other gods in my presence. Where I am with you, there are to be no other gods, is what he's saying. Or you'd have no other extra gods. It is to be a monotheistic relationship. One God. And you're to have a relationship with me. As God is everywhere, there is nowhere man can go to evade God's presence. So that it doesn't matter. I'm going to be everywhere you are. And I am everything you need. I don't know whether any of you read any of Mark Beaver's books. Mark Beaver is the senior pastor of Capital Baptist Church, Washington, D.C. And he's written quite a lot of books. One of them is called The 9 Marks of a Healthy Church. And he goes through different things that they say that church should have. The first mark, he said, of a healthy church is expository preaching. In other words, unpacking and explaining what the Bible says to us. The second is biblical theology, and the third is the gospel, and so it goes on. I won't go through them. Look them up. They're very good. He's a very good writer. Robin remembers him, I think, don't you, from Cambridge? He did his PhD at Cambridge. Lovely man. But what Mark Deaver comments is that, in essence, if you accept the first mark, i.e. expository preaching, you don't really need to mention the other eight, because they all follow on naturally. And we were saying just before the service that it's the same with the Ten Commandments, that if we accept the first commandment, that you're to have no other God except me, the others follow on logically and are just there. The direction is so complete and all-encompassing that we don't need any further revelation from God. If we just accept God as who he is and who he says he is, that's all I need. I am, God says. I am all you need. There must be nothing else in your life that comes anywhere close to taking the place that is rightfully mine. I always have a problem. I think, especially talking to children, it's very difficult to come up with the a definition of sin. I've heard many people do it, and I cringe often when people do this, and they have a children's address and they try to talk about sin, because inevitably you talk about sins, and that usually means that you mustn't tell lies, you mustn't cheat, you must obey your parents. Remember that, you must obey your parents, Peter. We have a little word this morning. It's great fun. Lovely, absolutely lovely. But we end up with this list of things, their to-dos and not-to-dos. Now, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that some bright children might say, well, I can do that. And if they're single-minded, they can. They can do it. They can obey exactly what you say. Does that make them right with God? No. The only satisfactory way I have tried to understand sin, I think this is something that God revealed to me, probably through reading and everything else, is that in essence, sin is idolatry. In other words, it's a complete going against this first commandment, that anything that takes the place of God in my life is against this first commandment, is therefore sin. Anything that takes the space that should be held by God in my life is sin. The commandment is very specific. And it's
okay, I found this on the web for Hey Sin Does the Commandment. Check it out.
There you go. Wow. That's nice, isn't it? Sorry, I didn't realise that. Isn't that good? Siri is coming to help. Wow. Thank you. The commandment is specific and very personal. It says you, and that's you singular, so we're talking about individuals. You are not to have other gods in my presence. But later on, God even tightens his requirements. In Exodus 34, he says, you shall worship, you again singular, shall worship no other God. Not even one. Nothing must take the place in your life that is rightfully mine. God is omnipresent. He can be and is everywhere and everywhere, anywhere and ever, at the same time. He is everywhere. He encompasses the earth. And therefore, there can be nowhere that we can go where God is not. Jonah found this out, didn't he? He tried to flee from the presence of God and found that God was still there. No idol is acceptable. From the thousands of gods in Egypt, the children of Israel had now to accept and obey Yahweh, the God of the patriarchs, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. He was their God if they would be his people, if they would be his people. It was a covenant relationship. It was a two-way thing. And I just look at this and I think it's a huge challenge to us today. If I was to ask any, I don't know many of you very well, but if I was to ask any of the fellowship here, and I am pointing at myself, do we have other gods? Do we worship idols? Do we obey this first of the commandments? Now, I'm confident that we would all say, with great sincerity and an emphatic no. No, we don't have any other gods. We serve God. We serve our Lord Jesus Christ, part of the Trinity, part of the Godhead. We serve him. But, these are one of the buts that come in, aren't they? If we're honest as well, we would also have to admit that there are idols in our life that so often do take the place that God requires. We do have sins which are idolatry. We allow things into our lives which shouldn't be there. It doesn't take much for different, quite acceptable actions and thoughts and all kinds of things to slip into our lives which become idolatry. Some people have all-consuming hobbies. Others will devote vast amount of time on things that they really love, be it a pet or something similar. I'm quite amazed at how some people treat their animals. I like dogs and cats. Elizabeth doesn't, but I like dogs and cats. I find them really lovely. They're nice. But, wow. I'm taken at times, and you can take me up on this, and have to be careful with this, but I'm taken at times by the number of photographs of children people have in their homes. There's nothing wrong with that at all. I can bore for England on my grandchildren, going from these great strapping things right the way down to the one-year-old who is a delight. And I often do bore people with pictures of my grandchildren. But some such displays in houses, they do make me uneasy. It's almost as if we have set up a shrine. And they are almost worshipped in some ways. Now, to love your children, your grandchildren, is absolutely right and proper, but there is a balance. We could look at many examples. I'm sure you could come up with some of your own, depending how much you wanted to confess, I suppose. But there is one idol that I think we all worship, whether we admit it or not, to a greater or lesser extent, and that idol is ourselves. You don't find yourself being selfish sometimes. You don't want to be, but there is always self-serving, often in the back of our minds, even when we do the nicest of actions. We sometimes do things because we want to be seen to be nice. We want to be seen to be good. And if you think about it, how often are our actions entirely selfless? Even our best is often tinged with self-interest. And so how can we really say we have kept this first commandment? I, the Lord, am your God, who brought you from the land of Egypt, from the house of slavery. You shall have no other God before me. I want to read you just a short paragraph from a commentary that is all about Exodus. And I think this sums up in some way the Moses and what's found there. You remember that Moses was, as I said, was wandering around as a shepherd in Midian, in the land of the Midianites. And whether he knew anything about God, we don't know. And he says, when Moses turned aside on Mount Sinai to the bush all aflame that strangely was not being burnt, he came into Yahweh's presence. From that moment on, Moses found himself in the stretching tension between ineffable mystery and pragmatic daily living. In the book of Exodus, he is presented struggling to convince a frightened and insecure people in a strange place of the reality of a God he himself knows but has never seen. There is little wonder at his asking Yahweh on Sinai, when he had won mercy for a compromised Israel, "Show me, please, your glory." That's what Moses had to come to. God had to deal with Moses before he could deal with the children of Israel. Moses had to be convinced of the claim of Yahweh on his life. And we have to be convinced of the claim of God on our lives before we can go out into the to the people who are outside those doors today.